To your February 1st Committee on Rules. My, how the time flies when you're having fun. Let's see, what are we going to do today? I invited Mr. Ruttlinger to talk. I should open a public hearing, but I just wanted to do a sort of a general of what we were doing. Invited Mr. Ruttlinger to talk to us about revolving doors since that piqued so much interest by the committee members. And then when we're done with Mr. Ruttlinger, we will send him back to bill drafting and amendment drafting. So I want to get him out of here as quickly as possible. Mr. Rocco is coming to talk about how we can pay for this creature, and hopefully we'll be here later on the morning. They have a number of amendments that I will have Marjorie walk through when we're done with Mr. Ruttlinger. And then I would certainly welcome testimony from all the interested parties in the room regarding amendments and input. The plan is to not vote on any of these today, but ponder them over the next several days. So, and then we do have some bill introductions. And I believe they're all law commission bills. All right, Mr. Ruttlinger, would you tell us a little bit about revolving door and amendments, et cetera?
Certainly, Madam Chair. For the record, Ted Reutlinger with Legislative Council. I understand that you would like to know what the existing law says about revolving door, subsequent employment of public officials. In the Ethics Code, there are two main provisions on that now. First, the law prohibits a public official from receiving a promise of public of subsequent employment based upon an understanding that the public official's vote or actions will be influenced by that offer. The second main piece is the existing law in 244.045 currently now prohibits certain public officials from going to work for private employers for 1 or 2 years after they leave public service. Specifically for employers that work in the area over which the public official had some regulatory authority. They're also prohibited from lobbying or appearing before the agency that they work for and from disclosing confidential information that they gained while they were a public employee. And the statute covers a variety of public officials, for example, PUC commissioners, the director of DCBS, the administrators of the Finance and Corporate Securities Division of DCBS, the administrator of the Insurance Division, the head of OLCC, and the head of the lottery, all cannot, within 1 year of leaving public service, go to work for a private employer that they regulated. They also cannot, in a 2-year period, lobby or appear before their former agency.
Senator Johnson.
I don't know, Mr. Ruttlinger, whether you know this, and I don't want to put you on the spot about the answer, but any history about why these agencies were selected versus any others that are managing, let's say, huge contracts, or I'm just trying to get my handle, my arms around why these?
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, you're right. I don't know the history of that. But looking at the law, it was the first version came into effect in 1987. It was amended in 1993, really the last time when these laws were significantly amended. And I think the state police provision, which I'll get to, was added in 1997.
Madam Chair, I'm not asking you to do any research on this at all. I'm merely posing it as an interesting question about these, whether or not it had to do with the magnitude of the fiscal transactions, the public perception. But please, given all the workload you have, don't research this.
Okay. I'll agree not to do that. The second part of this law, deputy attorney generals may not, within 2 years after they leave service at the Department of Justice, lobby or appear before the agency that they provided legal advice for while at the Department of Justice. Third, the state treasurer and the deputy state treasurer may not, within 1 year, accept employment from an entity that they negotiated a contract with of over $25,000. Or that they place an investment with of over $50,000. They also cannot be a lobbyist for an investment institution or appear in an advocacy capacity before the state treasurer. The fourth part is a public official who invests public funds may not, within 2 years after leaving office, lobby or appear before their former agency. They cannot try to influence the former agency or disclose confidential information. And the last piece is the state police officers who are involved in regulating tribal gaming or the lottery may not, within 1 year of leaving the state police, work for a tribe or a lottery in a position relating to gaming. They can't work for a gaming employer, somebody who sells gaming products. They can't try to influence the state police or disclose confidential information. That is what the statutes currently say. The law commission...
Ted, can I ask you a quick question on the invest public funds, the one right before tribal gaming?
Sure.
Would that include folks on the Oregon Investment Council, or is it in those who have are only employed by the state?
Senator Brown, that's a very good question that I'm not sure of the answer.
Okay.
I mean, the statute does not specifically identify members of the Oregon Investment Council, and I don't know how the law's been interpreted by the GSPC on that issue.
Madam Chair.
Senator Monson.
You said a public official, correct?
Correct.
So, and that would include elected officials?
Public official is the broadest definition, yes. So in theory, it could include elected officials. I don't know.
But
that
that's not...
That's not clear to me. I don't know the answer to that.
But that is not being enforced today at this point in time, because I believe there are some elected officials that... did join organizations that they did have influence over regarding their budgets, because we voted on it.
Senator Brown, Senator Monis-Anderson, I suspect that this particular subsection is interpreted more to apply to employees in state and local government
Thank
who
you.
Are the actual people who invest the money, as opposed to people who give the policy direction, but I'm not positive of that answer.
Thank you.
All right.
There are a couple of interesting provisions in the Oregon Constitution that are sort of related to this. Section 30 of Article 4 of the Constitution applies to members of the legislature, and it's the provision that says that during your term of office, you may not be appointed to an office that the legislature creates or an office that the legislature raises the salary for. That's a provision in the Constitution. Of course, it also prohibits you from holding anybody from holding two lucrative offices at the same time, or from serving in more than one branch of state government at the same time under the separation of powers provisions. And I can talk to you a little bit about what the Law Commission proposes on this subject if you would like.
That'd be useful. Thank you.
Generally, okay. The Commission is going to retain the current law about not receiving a promise of future employment and having that influence some action that you take as a public official. They're going to extend that in their bill to say that a public official may not accept a promise of future employment from a person who has matters pending before the agency that the public official works for. Third, the commission is proposing the same revolving door provision for members of the legislature that is contained in Senate Bill 10, which would prohibit lobbying for a session after the time that you leave the body. Fourth, they're adding a provision that says that a public official may not, for 2 years after leaving public position, have an interest in a contract that was authorized by the public official while they were a public official. Fifth, they are extending the ban on use of confidential information to continue after you leave public office, so it wouldn't apply just during the time that you are in public office. And the last one is that the law currently says that public officials may not represent a client for a fee before the governing body of the public body that they work for. The Law Commission bills would extend that slightly to say that you also cannot, for a fee, provide advice or other services for a fee that's somehow related to influencing the action of the public body that you work for. So that's a basic short summary of the Law Commission determinations on subsequent employment.
Questions? Senator Farrielli.
Madam Chair, I haven't had a chance to look through my packet, but... is that, were you speaking from your own notes?
I was.
And could those be made available to members by in written form?
Sure.
Thanks, because I'd like to have that to sort of do the comparisons. But thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Anything else? Okay. What do we have in front of us? Just dealt with one issue in terms of the time frame for legislators. I think the issue that Senator Farioli raised was whether agency heads who lobby would come under the provisions in Senate Bill 10 regarding the revolving door.
Madam Chair, is the question whether a member of the legislature who left the legislature became an agency head would be allowed to lobby?
Correct.
This does not exempt anybody. So I think the answer probably is that it would cover an agency head who left the legislature and went to state service to become a lobbyist. What this does say is that it covers people who lobby for a fee. So that would be the question. Does a state employee who lobbies lobby for a fee? Clearly the state employee is being paid a salary and not an additional fee to lobby. So on that basis, they might not be covered. But if you want those people in or you want those people out, the best approach would be to specifically put into this language that they are either exempted or not, so that it's clear.
Questions? All right. Thank you very much. Well,
thank you.
Let you get back to drafting. Yeah, I'm going to go. Thanks for all your hard work.
Thank
Continuing
you.
Hard work. Mr. Rocco, thanks for joining us this morning. We've got shields behind you so that nobody's stabbing daggers in your back as you speak.
I'm used to that, Madam Chair.
Yeah, but usually people stab you in front.
That's true.
In the back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ken Rocco, Legislative Fiscal Office.
Thank you.
At a previous meeting of your committee, we discussed with you a potential alternative funding for the Government Standards and Practices Commission. And you asked us to develop some more details on that. So what we've provided to you is a table that I can go through quickly just to that shows you how one possible way of funding this without giving the Government Standards and Practices Commission direct general fund. This would basically be through an assessment on state agencies and a diversion of certain revenues going to local governments. For the purposes of this, we assumed a 09-11 budget of $1.2 million, and that's just a rough estimate. The current governor's recommended budget for the agencies for 07-09 is about $930,000. The table shows the government entities. We've listed the state, Oregon Health and Science University, counties, cities, school districts, community colleges, and then an other category. The employee numbers we got from the fiscal year 2006 schedule of principal participating employers from the public employee retirement system. And this is the number of 157,000 public officials that you've been hearing about. The second column is the percent of that total 157,000 in each of the categories. And then the third column just shows you, based on that percentage of the total employees, what the share, each of these entities' share of the 1.2 million would be. And then the fourth column identifies the percentage of the funding source that we've identified in that note column to the far right. So, for example, for the state share of that $1.2 million would be roughly $291,000. And if you look at all of the general fund and other funds in state agencies, that would be about thousandths of a percent of the total revenues that those agents that flow through those agencies' budgets. Since we've, and the sources we've identified on this is for the state would be general fund, lottery, and other funds. For OHSU, it would be their general fund appropriation. For counties and cities, liquor apportionment. For the school districts, the state school fund, general fund, and lottery appropriation. And community colleges, the community college support fund appropriation. We're still at a loss to find an easily identified source for the other category. And so the alternative line shows you if we just assume that other share as part of the state responsibility and assess state agencies for that, it increases the state share from about $291,000 to $344,000. And then finally, at the bottom, we just took from the 0709 price list that's built into the currently budgets being discussed currently, what a typical assessment would be for agencies based on their budgeted FTE to come up with that $343,930 figure. So, for example, the Department of Human Services would roughly, their share would roughly be about $77,000. And we just selected a few of the larger agencies, and just to give you an idea of what the assessment would be. Those assessments then would be paid based on the agency's fund split. So it would be a combination of the general fund or their other funds resources that they get.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
I just want to make sure that I understand you, Mr. Rucco, that you pick these as representative agencies, but the theory would be every agency would participate, even the ones with the de minimis number of employees?
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, that's correct. These are just some examples, but all agencies would be assessed. And the Department of Administrative Services has an assessment process, and we could build this into the 0911 price list so that it would be just automatically built into agency budgets based on their budgeted FTE.
Thank you.
Senator Farrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I want to thank Mr. Rocco for his attentive service to the committee in bringing this forward. It gives me a much better idea of where the assessments would have to go and so forth. But, Madam Chairman, I would just like to point out again that any legislator that is seated or any legislature in the future could either raise or lower these assessments because, you know, we do a per capita assessment. And that appropriating dollars to these entities and then assessing them money back creates this assessment loop that really is an administrative expense that's unnecessary, in my opinion. But when you add to that the other funds appropriations, it helps to spread the load, and I understand that that might be a good theory, but other fund dollars that go to these local jurisdictions are really precious and irreplaceable dollars. They support mental health services, the revenue sharing from beer and wine to local districts and so forth and so on. Those dollars represent revenue streams that don't exist anywhere else and are irreplaceable. So, you know, the whole concept of providing a mechanism for the certainty of funding for the GSPC is no more achieved by doing an appropriation and assessment than it would be by a direct appropriation from the legislature, because it could be the assessment could be raised and lowered at will, and that appropriation and assessment generates cost, and that other funds being used in this mix tends to take irreplaceable dollars away from local jurisdictions. So I would just suggest, again, a direct appropriation of the general fund to support GSPC at the level that we understand they need to operate. And if it's $900,000 or if it's $1.2 million, we should just pick that number and do the appropriation.
Thank you, Senator Farrioli. I think you raised some good points. And Ken, I just really appreciate you coming forward with another proposal. I think now the cities and counties and other folks involved have two proposals, and I was pleased to have the Oregon Health Sciences University actually come forward and say we weren't being assessed in the prior proposal, and they are specifically saying we want to be assessed. So I guess what I would say to folks is we now have two proposals, and I'm open to other suggestions if folks have one, but the chair is committed to finding some sort of dedicated revenue source. I think once we taketh, it's harder to take back. So I just think we're in better shape actually having a dedicated revenue source. So, but Ken, I actually have a question, and then I'll come back to the senators, and that is my understanding of why you came forward with this particular proposal was because the administrative expense of the other proposal. So I assume by moving forward in a circumstance like this, we substantially reduce what administrative costs there would have been under the original proposal. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I believe that would be correct because there is no currently existing system to collect checks or dollars from each of these entities or the actual public official. So we thought that would be a higher administrative cost than this. And these diversions from these the state assessment can be done relatively simply through existing processes, and the diversion of these other resources could simply be done with some statutory language, we believe. And now we haven't checked with Legislative Council on the mechanics of that yet, but that would be something we could do if you want to proceed.
Okay, thank you. And then my other question is, if we could also choose to weight it differently, could we not, to impact the other smaller, the other revenue sources? We could have the state, for example, bear 50% of the responsibility, and the other jurisdictions, essentially have their responsibilities.
Madam Chair, absolutely. You could do that in any manner you saw fit.
All right. Thank you. Sarah Nelson.
Just a suggestion. It seems like we're getting complicated with this thing. Would just a direct checkoff from the number of income tax returns filed dedicated to this, is there, what is the issues that we'd have there? Say, like, is there a million income tax returns filed in the state of Oregon, just $1 just comes right off the top of that, isn't it? What's wrong with that idea?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, I don't believe there's anything wrong with it. I think it's something that could be looked into also as a possible way of collecting revenue.
I guess my sense is that part of the reason we're doing this is it's the end result is the public's right to know, and so... it's not a direct appropriation, but it's set in stone that $1 for every tax return that's filed would be dedicated to this system. So,
We'll have staff look into that, Senator Nelson.
Okay, because there might be some problems with that.
Let's take a look at it. Sir Johnson.
Several things. First of all, I'd also like to thank Mr. Rocco for the responsiveness of the Legislative Fiscal Office. Secondly, to in light of the two proposals that the chair is now referencing, I took some time after being critical of the Secretary of State's reporting process to meet with Mr. Lindbeck and the Secretary of State, and I wanted to acknowledge publicly that some of my concerns about the perceived or real problems with that system have been ameliorated. And so I just want to be on the record as having made the effort to go down and at least chat with them and take a look at that system. I had made comments about building another system on top of a platform that may not be able to accept it. And so some of my concerns have been ameliorated about that. With respect to this proposal, there's a certain elegance in the sharing concept of this responsibility. I'm of the opinion that assuring the citizens of Oregon that we have good ethical controls and processes in place is very important, recognizing that the state participates in generating some of those complaints, but certainly local government contributes. And so there's something somewhat elegant about this proposal. I'm mindful of the pressure on local government, and I'm sure that they will be here to vociferously express their opposition to their participation. But again, I would like, during the course of this hearing, to have perhaps GSPC, remind us of the proportional share of issues raised before GSPC that emanate with local government and the ones that come from the state. So, again, I would like to thank Mr. Rocco for this.
Thank you. Other questions? Anything else? Senator Farrelly.
I don't doubt that we're all aiming at the same target, and that is adequacy of funding for the GSPC. And I acknowledge the elegance of having the various trophic levels provide an element of support, since, you know, those complaints some do generate from those local jurisdictions. I would suggest, though, in counterpoint to that we all serve the same constituents, and we're all elected by the same people, and the citizens of Oregon have a broadly based public interest in GSPC being fully funded. And so I think you could look at that at either one end of the telescope or the other end of the telescope and get to the same place. So I would, again, argue for the general fund appropriation. The other alternative that we could have would be to simply appropriate $1.2 million to legislative fiscal and assess each of their 159 employees $7,547.16. And that would be a certainty appropriated and a very easy method to collect the dollars, because we know where Ken Rocco lives.
You're going to make him throw up.
You don't need to respond to that unless you choose to.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm just thrilled that Senator Farrelly would trust me with $1.2 million.
Trust you with a lot more than that, Mr. Rocco. I just, for the record, I just wanted to point out, I actually have two goals in terms of the funding for the commission. One, of course, is adequacy, but the other is to remove what I perceive as the direct conflict of interest of legislators having direct tie over the agency, holding the purse strings to the agency to which who is supposed to hold us accountable for Oregon's ethics laws. So there are really two goals here, Senator Farrelly, and I guess that's my concern, and I don't believe the general fund funding meets that goal, and I think the last 15 years of the up and downs of the GSPC are proof enough of that argument. I think the advantage of having a dedicated statutory funding mechanism is that the legislature would actually have to remove the funding mechanism, and I think that's a much more difficult task than we might think so. I realize that every legislature can change everything we do this time around, but I just would submit to you that I think it's more difficult for once we were to impose a statutory funding mechanism for us to get rid of it, and I think there are a number of people in this room who would, shall I say, fight like hell to make sure that wouldn't happen. So, all right, any other questions for Ken, and we should let him go, make sure he's spending the rest of the billions of dollars we're giving him very carefully. Thank you very much, Ken. We really appreciate your hard work. All right, Marjorie, would you like to walk through the amendments we have in front of us at this point in time, and then we'll open it up to testimony?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have seven amendments in front of you. The dash one removes volunteers from the list of public officials. Dash two and dash three are similar in that dash two says that this bill doesn't apply to public bodies with fewer than 50 public officials, and dash 3 is fewer than 100 public officials. The dash 5 changes the implementation date from January 1st, 2008 to July 1st, 2009. Dash 6 has to do with the contributions and expenditures and violations. Dash 7 is a procedure for GSPC to follow through when a person doesn't file their paperwork. And dash 8 has to do with the revolving door for legislators, and this just says that the door applies to the next legislative session, not the regular session.
Comments for staff about amendments? And Senator Farrelly, you're having some other amendments drafted, as I recall.
Yes, ma'am. And I don't know what timeline they'll be available, but we'll try to make that as timely as possible.
That'd be great. Thank you. I have Paul. We are in a public hearing, aren't we, as we've been going through all this. I have Paul Snyder signed up to come testify. I'm happy to welcome anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify. I was like, no, we don't want to testify in front of her today. In the back of the packet, behind the bill introductions. Thanks, and welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paul Snyder, Association of Oregon Counties, appearing here by mistake. I thought with all these people, there was another sign-up sheet, so I was signing the second one.
Okay.
Turns out there is no other sign-up sheet, and I'm the only one.
Okay, that's great.
I think, Madam Chair, the issues that we've had before, we continue to have. The committee has heard them before. I don't see any need to just reassert what they are. Commenting on the Dash 1 amendments, though, and I don't want to take up your time on something that might get changed further, but one aspect to it has been the subject of a couple email exchanges already, and that is the amorphous nature of other terms than volunteer, including in particular agent and otherwise. It's really hard to figure out who you count when you continue to, when we're using that basis for establishing who should pick what. And the committee's already heard that. Senator Ferrioli and others have raised our issues as well. And that's really all I have to say.
Sarah Monis Anderson.
To that end, the mayor and the city councilors in Gresham are volunteers. I mean, they are not paid anything. And the school board members of the school districts are all volunteers, and they're not paid anything. So I guess I would need to ask you, Madam Chair, would they be considered not a public official? I mean, to me it doesn't make sense that they are not compensated. They may be given travel money, so maybe that's a form of compensation.
Sarah Monis Anderson, I think if you look at the language under the Dash 10-1 amendments, it states public official means any person from the date the commission charges the public body under the statute is serving the public body as an elected official, officer, employee, agent, or otherwise. And I think actually the issue revolves around what is an agent, right? That's the issue. Okay. And that does not include an unelected position as a volunteer without compensation or on a part-time basis. And I think what we were trying to access there was seasonal employees that I know the local communities hire on a somewhat regular basis. So
I also need clarification on those that are appointed to commissions and agencies. Where would they fit? Is that...
I know, that's a good question under this definition. Agent? We think that might be agent. We sent Mr. Rettlinger back to work, so we will follow up on that, and because we obviously think it's important to cover boards and commissions, I assume is the point you're getting at.
Exactly.
Okay. They are paid per diem. I'm not sure that is covered, so we'll figure out. Other questions for Mr. Snyder? Dave, did you have anything?
No.
Good. All right. Thank you very much. Anybody else wishing to testify? Mr. Bennett, come on up. Sorry.
Hi.
Hi. It's so good to see you.
Nice seeing you. Thanks.
All right.
Madam Chair, I'm Chuck Bennett with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. And during the interim, Madam Chair, I had the opportunity to serve on the Law Commission's work group on this set of issues, and thoroughly enjoyed the year-long discussion of ethics and all the rest of it. And I thought one of the really difficult problems was trying to figure out how to find the kind of independent funding that's needed for the GSPC and find a way to, as you've described, I think, fairly create as clear a protection for that funding as is possible given the nature of our form of government. And I, along with anyone else I think that's looked at this closely, would compliment Mr. Rocco for the The term was elegance of his solution.
Do I hear a butt coming?
Butt. Get it all out before I got to the butt.
As big as a bowling ball.
And probably the elegance is only marred by this one little problem we spotted.
Okay.
And that would be, we would just ask, as you look at the portion dealing with public school employees, assuming school districts referenced in Mr. Rocco's memos includes ESDs, and we'll just assume that we're talking about pretty much the entire education system in the state, we would ask that you take a look at how you access the funds. We're not arguing about the funds. We certainly are less concerned when we look at your Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 10, if those are to pass, that defines more clearly what a public official is and removes volunteers. What we would ask is that when you look at that portion assigned to school districts, which is about 42% of this thing, that you include that under a Department of Education cost rather than through the state school fund. We are very jealous of the state school fund and the way it's accessed. We have for several sessions had problems with a Secretary of State's request to access the state school fund to pay for performance audits. We have, we believe, worked out, possibly, we hope, some accommodation working through the Department of Education. We tend to like to see the department as our state-level representative, and this would be the place to go for the money. It may well be coming from the state school fund. It could be coming from the common school fund. That's not the issue to us. It really is how those funds are accessed. If you were to assess us, you would develop the information at the Department of Education. It seems like just if you're looking for administrative efficiency, just collect the money at the same place you develop the information.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett. And I assume you've talked to the superintendent and she's in agreement with that proposal.
We have not talked to the superintendent.
Okay. Just checking.
At some point, we will at some point. But,
quickly. Yes. Okay. Ms. Wimmer-Whalen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for your record. Lori Wimmer-Whalen with the Oregon Education Association. Echoing what Mr. Bennett just said to you, as a former agency head whose job it was to bite the hand that fed us, we understand what you're trying to do, and we're supportive of that. But we do want to bring your attention to both the issue of whether or not ESDs are included in this line item, and also echo the idea of not scooping into the state school fund. It seems just a slippery slope. I could just imagine future legislative sessions and seeing that as the piggy bank. So if there's a way to do it otherwise, I know that right now the Department of Ed, for example, holds aside some of the revenues from the state school fund to create the reimbursement fund for special education that exceeds the cap. So that's not a novel idea. They're already doing it for that, for example. So I thought I'd add that to the record.
Thank you. Okay, a couple questions, and then I suspect my colleagues might have some other questions. I guess in sort of a prioritization, and I think, I don't know if either one of you were present last week when Ken testified about the assessment fee, and essentially the cost of the assessment would double because of the cost of developing a system. So in terms of a preference between, and I hear what you're saying about the state school fund, between this and actually having an assessment which would double the cost to the school districts, which would be your preference?
We would prefer not to pay double, I think, would be
okay.
The easiest.
All right, that's a good answer. And then my second question is, if we were to essentially change the percentage of responsibility, which we can easily do, I would assume that doesn't change your response, because what you're wanting to do is hold, I'm trying to think of an appropriate word, hold the state school fund harmless from sort of nitpicking. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's
okay. All right. Questions for this panel?
Sir Ferrioli.
To Mr. Bennett, Madam Chair, the law, as you sat on the law commission, obviously they wrestled with the concept that you can't create a lockbox to which the legislature does not have the key.
Right.
So was the discussion essentially just a symbolic gesture? Was it, I mean, what, you know, those folks are pretty intelligent about what the powers are vested in the legislature. What was the discussion, and did they finally conclude that you're just making this gesture toward inviolability that really is insubstantial?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, I'm trying to recall the discussion.
And if you don't recall, we have folks from the Law Commission that are here that might be able to save you. So, okay.
Could resolve it. I recall that there was a discussion of this. We spent, it struck me, a lot of time on other issues. This was one of those, as I recall, that, at least from my perspective, really was the best recommendation is get it as close to a locked box as you can find. I mean, it was essentially protect the city's budget and create the kind of independence we expect. The details of that discussion would really probably Wendy or someone from the staff would more clearly be able to explain. I just honestly don't recall the details of it.
I'm sure I get the why. I really do. I understand why people are trying to get this done. It's just the idea that it's an impossibility to make it more difficult to access one fund than another. Because the process to create the fund or uncreate the fund is exactly the same. And I'll point out, we will have to appropriate dollars every year in an appropriation and to give the agencies authority by limitation every year. So, in fact, we'll be voting this bill every year, even if we create this mythical lockbox. So, you know, I totally understand why people want to have an independent funding mechanism that's utterly inviolable. It doesn't exist, and it can't exist.
Yeah.
So to say that we could do that is a gesture, but it's no more difficult to create than it is to uncreate, and the process is identical.
I just couldn't agree with you more in that so much of Senate Bill 10 is a gesture. To the public, and begin to reinforce public confidence, and in some cases recreate public confidence in institutions. And gestures in this entire ethics area become very, very important. And I think to the extent that we can make the gesture toward an independent funding source, even though there are keys to it. I think the public confidence in the integrity of GSPC and hopefully the realization that it has achieved a level of funding that guarantees it can provide a level of performance that supports public confidence in these institutions is just really essential. I know in my heart of hearts as a lobbyist, sending somebody some flowers has nothing to do, despite the fact it may cost $51, has absolutely nothing to do with the interrelationship on other issues. But there is some symbolic problem there that's been identified, and this may be part of that whole thing. I think we just got to resolve some of these issues. So that would be, I guess, sort of where I learned last year on the work group.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. I'm sorry, Ms.
Well, while you're there.
Okay. Lori, go ahead.
Just real quick. I'm still on this. What?
Great, okay.
School districts have a number of volunteers, and I'm still wanting to make sure that we clarify this regarding finance budget committees. I assume that would be an agent, but they're all volunteer regarding they're appointed by the superintendent, or they volunteer, I forget. And then many schools have foundation boards raising money, all volunteers for the school districts. Any comments on what is an agent and what is a volunteer?
Madam Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, right now we're looking at these Dash 1 amendments, and I haven't heard testimony on them yet to really understand if this gets all the way to the question of agency. And agency certainly in Oregon is has a fairly broad definition, but it seemed to us that the Dash 1s resolved the question of volunteers. We would be very concerned if you started looking at asking us to cover, or that you would even want to cover every member of an LSAC out there, or, you know, I mean, it would get to a certain point of diminishing returns. This dash one appears to go to the heart of that by defining public official and really talking about the folks that we would anticipate being covered. The only question I had, and it was some confusion I guess I had in reading Senate Bill 10, I had thought the discussion would really focus on statement of economic interest reporters, that's really who this was about, and that's who the charge would be based on. This kind of goes to Senator Ferrioli's apt suggestion that you could just charge $7,000 for everyone at LFO. I mean, it might be a higher charge, but you'd be talking about people who are reporters rather than talking about some sort of broad group. Under this, it would appear that it would be certainly the folks that I represent in the administration. It would be school board members. Then you'd get down to teachers, possibly custodians, and the question would be, does that represent the right mix, or should you be talking about only that group that reports under the SEI stuff, to the department? And you know, broad-based cost distribution creates a perceived lower fare. You know, it just looks like it was cheaper. It really isn't, but it looks like it was less expensive, and I think Senator Ferrioli's question goes right to the heart of that for me. I don't know.
Senator Ferrioli?
It's just all coming from the same source, Madam Chair.
Sure.
I think we've had a little confusion earlier about who files versus who's covered.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's covered. You know, you don't have to file necessarily, but virtually everyone connected with a public entity is subject to the GSPC ethics laws. So, I mean, I think that's where
thank you. Thank you. You relieve my
your anxiety.
Question. Yeah, my anxiety.
Okay. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Mr. Bryan, why don't you come on up? Thank you. And I don't know, Ms. Johnson, do you want to come up and talk about what the law, while we're in the middle of this discussion, talk about what the Law Commission discussed in terms of dedicated funding, since you're here and since I know you know the answer?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. I apologize for my cold today. Hopefully you'll be able to understand me. The Law Commission did struggle with this issue of funding a great deal. The work group worked through it a lot. But as Senator Ferrioli has pointed out, there really is no way to insulate the GSPC's funding as any other agency in the state because of the Constitution. I mean, this body has the power of the purse, period. The only way to essentially isolate this budget issue would be a constitutional amendment. This agency has been underfunded for, you know, many years. We don't know what the appropriate level is yet. We're still trying to determine what functions this agency should be handling, how to improve the agency. So to try to figure out what that dollar was before the session, it was impossible for the commission to decide as well. And so to put in the Constitution now what that number is, I mean, it's a moving target. But I think what the Law Commission wrestled with was the LFO process, the ways and means process, if you will, makes sense in this building. You don't know each year what facilities you have available, how many people you have available, costs of electronic equipment, all that type of thing. It changes. So to set in stone a number is difficult to do. So we thought originally of trying to put a number that was the floor. We still went with that number that in our recommendation of putting in a floor and then requiring a cost of living type of adjustment each session to put in statute. But the second part of it was, well, where should the funding source come from? And we struggled. We looked at Senate Bill,
420
from last session. And that bill obviously didn't get too far last session because it was an assessment on local governments. Everybody recognized that local governments do have a number of these cases, but to assess them was costly. And difficult to foresee each biennium how many cases are going to have and how to do it fairly. And it is, as Senator Ferrioli pointed out, an issue for the whole state, and it is tax dollars, whether you're taking it from a special district or a county or a city or the state. It's a tax dollar from some source anyway. So a general fund assessment seems the most logical and the most cost efficient. Because we did ask those two questions. Is it a political decision or is it an actual lockbox? And it really, every time we looked at trying to do something other than general fund, it really was just a political way to address the issue, but it wasn't actually functionally different. So that's the best we could come up with to try to help with the problem. But in the end, this body will always have the last answer of how to fund this agency. Hopefully that addresses your questions.
Questions for Wendy?
She nailed it, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Appreciate you joining us. Thank you. Mr. Bryant, Ms. Pellegrino, take it away.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, my name is Martha Pellegrino, representing the City of Portland. I just wanted to make a couple of general comments and then discuss a couple of issues with the Dash 1 amendments. First of all, I want to acknowledge and recognize the committee's hard work on trying to think of different funding sources and also recognizing the need to exclude volunteers, both from an administrability, administrability point of view. Just wanted to say that the City of Portland is certainly very supportive of the work of the GSPC, and we recognize that this agency plays a very valuable role in monitoring the state ethics laws and enforcing those laws to the extent that members of local government are part of that. We do see that. City will not object to paying a small assessment in order to fund the GSPC. We are concerned about precedent and future precedent for future funding streams, especially when we're talking about diverting a percentage of the city's shared revenues to support the operations of a state agency. It appears that the state giveth and the state taketh away before we actually see those dollars to fund services like police and fire. So to whatever extent that the committee is sensitive to those issues, we appreciate that. And also to the extent that it's possible to have a maximum amount of assessment capped in the statute, that would also certainly give it make it a little bit more palatable from where we're sitting and help us to foresee what a future impact of this is going to be. We are supportive of looking at proportional solutions for this. In terms of the Dash 1 amendment specifically, I will echo some of the concerns about the definition of agent or otherwise in the amendment. This, it implicates seasonal employees, it implicates contractors, and from where the city is, it would be a very difficult number to come up with any accuracy. Our recommendation would essentially be that we look at the total number of FTE plus elected officials. That is a number that's easily accessible and one that we can give with some certainty. The other issue in the Dash 1 amendment is the point at which the local government is charged, and the way it reads in the Dash 1 is that essentially when the GSPC sends out a bill or makes that determination, a reasonable determination or a way that I think that you can also have some certainty there and clarity is by looking at the public agency's budget, the last approved budget. So, for example, at the City of Portland, we were to look to our last approved budget and look toward FTE and full-time employees, we would have a number of about 5,700. That would take us about 5 minutes to come up with that number. So if we could essentially have some clarity there, that would be very useful on our end. I think that is I think that's the extent of our comments. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Steve Bryant, representing the League of Oregon Cities, and I won't repeat repeat prior testimony. Again, we're very supportive of the general tone of Senate Bill 10 and what it attempts to do. And we're not going to spend a lot of our political capital on a fee that isn't a big ticket item for our communities. We would agree that we think there are more cost effective ways to essentially collect the amount of money that GSPC certainly needs to effectively operate or carry out their charge. We generally have a position that opposes off-the-top allocations from state shared revenues. To give you a parallel example, something you, if you haven't heard from us, you likely will, there's a proposal in the governor's budget to take 2% off of the liquor taxes to fund specific programs that would have the effect of reducing state shared revenues. We're opposed to that kind of trend, so we're a little bit concerned about any effort to take off-the-top distributions to fund programs that are, have a broad application. We also, though, are appreciative of your effort to try to come up with some sort of formula approach to so that it would take two steps, as you say, to really affect the GSPC budget. And I just wonder if some percentage of the general fund couldn't be used just as easily to create that statutory first step allocation to fund the GSPC. And I want to echo Martha's comments about a simplified system. If we are going to use this mechanism, we look at our PERS covered payroll as of the previous budget document is certainly easy to do. I'd also comment that in your 156,000 employee estimate, I think I heard testimony at one of your earlier meetings that they're probably closer to 170 or 180,000 public employees when you include the non-PERS employees. I'm not sure what that number is, but I think we could probably help you get it if that's important. Again, I want to emphasize the agent or otherwise language emphasize that I think what you're trying to do is get at some estimate or some amount of proportionality. And if the intent is to include board and commission members to arrive at that, I think that's a mistake. I think you can arrive at that proportionality if you simply stop at elected official, officer, or employee. Many of our small communities have far more board and commission members than they have employees. Some of our larger communities have boards and commissions that rarely, if ever, meet. When I was in Albany, we had a hospital authority commission that met maybe once every 5 years to help issue bonds for the local hospital. And we have library boards. At one time, we had a boxing commission. And so you've got all these boards and commissions that I don't think really are ever going to come under the scrutiny of GSPC. And I think you can get at this proportionality issue simply by limiting that sentence to elected official, officer, or employee. So we appreciate this. I'll comment just briefly on the dash 2 and 3 amendments. That would be of great help to us. The vast majority of our members actually have fewer than 100 public officials under this definition. That doesn't help your proportionality argument, but it certainly is going to be an irritant to be assessing our communities for something that they don't directly see the benefit from very often. Our larger communities probably have a greater understanding and appreciation of what happens here. And as I say, it's not a big ticket item to us, but we'd like to help you do anything that reduces the administrative cost to collect whatever fee that you collect. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Sir Johnson.
I apologize for stepping out for a second. I'm struggling with the idea that your smaller cities aren't interested in having a well-functioning ethics operation that reassures the city of Oregon, I mean the citizens of Oregon, that all public officials are behaving in a certain manner and are under the scrutiny of an ethics watchdog.
Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, I didn't mean to say they don't appreciate the need. I think I give you an illustration. We fund an organization called the Local Government PERS Alliance, and that's the organization we form to get school districts and cities and counties and special districts together and talk about PERS issues and fund a position to really speak with one voice on PERS issues. And we levied an assessment of $5 per PERS employee to our member cities. And I heard more from the small cities that said, you know, that $25 bill is just, it seems kind of ridiculous that we're having to do this, and it's a hardship for us, and we've got to take it to our city council. And I said, well, okay, I understand that. in the end, most of them participated, but a few of them just simply didn't. And it's more problematic for these small communities to go through the budget process and have these debates about, are we going to pay this bill or not? And I guess I'm just saying it would be helpful if we could avoid that discussion by some kind of de minimis exemption for the smaller jurisdictions rather than go through the cost and expense of sending out a small bill. That's my
Thank
point.
You.
Oh, by the way, may I, Madam Chair, say the one thing that would be helpful to all of our members that I think we support and I think they will learn to appreciate, and that's the training function that's built into this. I think we really need that training function for our members to help them understand these issues, and I think they'll begin to see the value when that happens.
Senator Johnson. I'm glad that you raised that question, because in budget hearings about GSPC's budget in previous sessions, the methodology for delivery of training became a subject of quite heated conversation, whether or not one person was responsible for the face of GSPC, or whether you could do train the trainers, or whether you could do videotapes of the one person able to deliver the message. And I completely agree with you that when smaller cities see value in products emanating from GSPC, that it makes the rigorous debate and paperwork preparation over a $25 bill perhaps more understanding. I just reject wholesale that a community would have a hard time finding comfort in statewide ethics oversight over a $25 bill. That just makes me laugh.
Senator Ferriello, did you have a question as well?
Oh, it's just a series of observations, Madam Chairman. Thank you for recognizing me. What I heard is that if we instituted a cap, now we've got cost shifting involved in this process. And I certainly appreciate, having served on a city council, the fact that it costs you $150 to get an authorization for a $25 check. You know, by the time you count the administrative costs and the hearing and the approval and the writing of the letter and the accounting of the dollars and the transmittal of the letter and the subsequent accounting of the expenditure, it's a lot of hassle for a little amount of money. And I can see that the cities where they are large jurisdictions or small jurisdictions are going to spend their time chasing the numbers. And the number will have to be an audited number. And people will argue about the number. And some will say it's higher. And some will say it's lower. And if the audit committee has to deal with it, then it's way more hassle than it's worth. And finally, Madam Chair, I was just thinking that in many of my communities, a single individual serves on many boards and commissions. And that poor person will be repeatedly assessed over and over and over again. A hospital board member, the school board member, the library board volunteer, the you name it. And in most of my communities, the same four people serve on 62 boards, and we're going to get them every time they walk into a room. So I would just suggest, Madam Chair, it would be a lot easier for us to figure out, even though we might miss the symbology of having this spread like oil on water across 157,000 people, just to make an assessment of a fair assessment of what it's going to cost to fully fund GSPC, appropriate those dollars, and make sure that the electorate understands, woe be the legislator who fails to vote affirmatively on the appropriation for GSPC when they go to the home folks. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Does that mean you're in support of the -2 and the -3 amendments?
Madam Chairman, I love this bill.
Okay.
We're just going to have to work through it.
All right. Thank you. Janice Thompson.
Good morning. Janice Thompson, Money and Politics Research Action Project. I just wanted to touch a little bit also on the history of the discussions within the ethics work group. Like Chuck Bennett, I was also an invited participant into that process, and I think his characterization of it is the overall interest of that group trying to, you know, send a message of trying to get as strong a lockbox kind of approach as possible is what it was kind of the goal. It is a topic that came up towards the tail end, and so I think there were also some issues just with kind of starting to run out of time given the great scope of activities. I do have a correction to a comment by Wendy Johnson. I actually worked with Senator Brown on Senate Bill 420 in 2005, and it does not just apply to local governments. And it's very similar to kind of the process described in Senate Bill 10. And I think that that the 420, so I think the other factor in terms of what the ethics work group is, I don't think they really quite took a look at this exact kind of approach, and so I think it's why, you know, it's partly coming back up. As others have said, I really want to thank the Legislative Fiscal Office for their kind of continued kind of, you know, nudging away. And I think what I said yesterday was like, you know, we need more thinking about it, and that's what's really great, as well as just all of the discussion, I think, is indicating to me that the first goal that Senator Brown indicated in terms of an adequate goal funding is shared. And so, you know, that's really, really great. But I just do want to echo Senator Brown's interest in that second goal, that budget insulation goal. And even if some future legislature can obviously, you know, shift something, I think that taking this approach sends a definite message to future legislative body of the importance of meeting this budget insulation goal. And within this, echo what Chuck Bennett said, is that maybe a gesture, but gestures are important.
Thank you. Questions? In terms of approaches, any strong feelings with the original Senate Bill 10 approach, or the, we'll call it, for lack of better words, Ken Rocco proposal?
Well, I think the balancing act here is between the Rocco approach having probably less administrative burden and cost, with the concerns about precedent setting that folks have mentioned about, you know, shaving off this. I did really appreciate the comment, I believe it was from the City of Portland, about maybe one way to help reassure folks in that regard is to have some sort of cap. And the original Senate Bill 420 approach did implicitly kind of have, it set a floor, but it also had kind of a cap into it. So that might be a way to get at that. But I recognize that that's a really, you know, it's a serious question. And so that's the balancing act. But the approach in terms of identified by Mr. Rocco does really address those administrative costs concerns.
Great. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Anybody else wishing to testify? Mr. Burson, you're jumping up and down. Come on up.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
This may seem like a very trivial point, but I think it's worth raising. I would like to find a different way to characterize the material that was prepared by LFO. That office tries assiduously to maintain neutrality, to stay out of policy.
That's probably fair.
And I just don't think it's fair to their efforts for us to characterize their work product in a different way.
So how would you like to characterize it?
Call it the proportional.
Okay, the proportional approach.
Proposal or something other than.
All right.
It's a little point, but I think it's a serious point.
No, I take your comment seriously. Mr. Burson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Ron Burson, Executive Director for Government Standards and Practices Commission. I'd like to comment on the Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendments. One concern that I had with those.
Yes.
Yeah. Sorry, just 1 second. Is the definition of a public body. Many of our state agencies have less than 50 or less than 100 employees, and I was wondering if the intention here was the public body was actually the state of Oregon or a school district or a county, or was it the individual actual schools in that school district, because there's many schools that are under that. And so I would propose that if we were looking at public body, we actually define it as the big umbrella type of look at it that way, as opposed to look at the individual agencies or individual jurisdictions underneath there. So that was
okay.
That was the big concern that we had.
While you're here, strong feelings about the assessment approach or the proportional approach?
Madam Chair, we could call it the GSPC approach. I don't know if that counts, but... I haven't had a chance to look at what Mr. Rocco had presented to the committee today, but we as the GSPC have been in favor of looking for more diversified ways of funding our agency. And from just what he had testified to, it is something that it sounds like we would be in favor of.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Burson, Ron Burson?
Madam Chair, thank you. I guess I don't see the diversification. The point is these are tax dollars that we would appropriate or we would offer through revenue sharing to the local jurisdictions and then either withhold by prior appropriation or we would assess for, which would create a significant cost, maybe even doubling the administrative cost of the program. So I appreciate the fact that in a perfect world we would have many sources that are real sources, but in point of fact we only have one source and it's the tax dollar.
Chair Brown, Senator Ferrioli, I understand that the majority dollars would come from tax dollars, but I also look at, and I'll just use the state of Oregon as an example, if we were to assess the state of Oregon whatever proportion that was, that those dollars would not only come from, like you say, general fund and lottery, but there also would be other funds, and so there could be dedicated funds that are out there that are not tax dollars. In other words, there could be fees from licensure, different sources like that that may not be taxes, but I understand that the majority of them still would be taxes of some sort. It just would not all be resting on personal income taxes, and that's what I meant to say when the GSPC is in favor of that. It would be several different types of taxes.
Okay. Sarah Nelson.
Just a quick question, Ron. And Senator, in the amendments dash 2 and 3, does it bother you, or do you have any comment on the fact that we're putting a finite number? You know, it's 50 or it's 100. It seems to me that wherever you do that, you're always going to have problems because somebody's going to fit on one side or the other side, and it's. I mean, I think that's a lot of this whole issue is, you know, even with the money things we're talking about. Okay, where do you draw the line, and what is really significant? So.
Chair Brown, Senator Nelson, if you're asking me if I'm comfortable with with one of these lines that are drawn right now, I don't know if I'm comfortable with the number 50 or 100, but am I comfortable with drawing a line? I think that it's needed because, there may be, again, we go back to, some jurisdictions that are out there that simply are either not getting enforcements from the state and we actually would have to collect from them, and it may become more burdensome to collect from them than actually what the money is worth at that point. But I'm also in favor of what Senator Johnson had testified to or had spoken to earlier, that I'm sure it doesn't matter whether you come from a city of a million or if you come from a city of 100. I think the citizens of that city still want to make sure that their public officials are at a level that is set by statute in the state of Oregon as far as their ethics go. So it's difficult for us to come up with a line also. I guess to answer your question, I'm uncomfortable with the line, but I understand there's probably going to be a need for that line. Just to administer the program.
Thank you. Anything else? Ms. Ingram, did you want to testify? Okay. And we have, for the record, we have copies of an email from Ms. Ingram dated January 31st, 5:58 p.m. for the record. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee. That was exactly what I wanted to speak to. Just with late evening conversations with, General Ingram, Executive Director, Oregon Fire District Directors Association, just wanted to make sure the suggestions from our legal counsel were entered into the record. There was concern about local governments being assessed on the date the commission charges the public body. For simplification and ease, we suggest that employee records as of the first day of the fiscal year might be considered. Secondary, the concerns about agent or otherwise have already been expressed, but the concern that if there is a legal counsel hired for a district, whether they use that legal counsel in a particular year or not, does that person count or not? And then finally, the third suggestion was with regard to compensation. Sometimes volunteers receive a reimbursement for gas or things of that nature, a small stipend, and yet they are considered volunteers. We wanted to make sure those were addressed. We have submitted conceptual language and just wanted to make sure that was on the record. And thank you for your time.
Questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate you joining us. Pat, we're going to close
Madam Chair, before you close the record,
we
heard some really eloquent testimony about the importance of gestures, and I don't disagree at all that I think gestures are important. But I think you have to look at the gesture of doubling the administrative cost of a program. And, you know, that sends a message here, too.
Thank you, Senator Ferriero. Senator Johnson?
I may have missed this, but where is it that we double the cost of the administrative program?
I think under the proposal set forth in Senate Bill 10, that Legislative Fiscal reported that the administrative costs would be high. And I think the issue is whether you have the administrative costs under the proportionality proposal or not.
They would be lower. But we're not. I don't think we have Adam characterized, Madam Chair.
I'm sure we can get costs on that, but that's probably a ways and means discussion item, too. So, thanks. Anything else? All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 10. Stay tuned. We really appreciate your comments on the amendments as we move towards this process, towards the completion of this process. I'm going to open a work session for the purpose of introducing committee measures. Colleagues, you have a number of LCs in front of you. They are all related to government ethics. They are all from the Oregon Law Commission. I would beg your indulgence that I not have to read the measure summary, or we'll be here probably until about 12:15. Is that all right? All right. I'm open to work session. I move that LCs 593, excuse you, Gesundheit, LC 1138, LC 1225, LC 1226 and LC 599. These are all bills regarding the Earth Ethics Work Group, and LC 1350 and 2320, which are other Law Commission bills, be introduced as committee bills. Any discussion? Did I miss 591? And apparently I said 599 when I meant 591. Any discussion with that correction? Any objection? So ordered. Thank you very much for your courtesy. So great. And we're adjourned for the day. We'll be back sometime next week.
Could you inquire about the group that was here?
Yes, and folks didn't want to be introduced. So.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. So you can go say hello to our guests. All right.